Hi friends, Jake here, just jumping in to say that this episode was recorded way back in January of 2022, which was before we decided on this sort of new direction we're going with the podcast, thinking more broadly about adaptation. If you do want to hear more about that and what to expect in the future, go listen to last week's episode called A Man Named Twix, based on the story that Caleb got told down the pub. But yeah, this is very much a classic episode where we just think about telling the story through theatre, and because it was recorded in January, there are some references to that time of year, such as Omicron and the like, but on the whole, like the never-ending story, it is pretty timeless. Here's the pod.
Well, this is just something I worked up. I'll do it for you, maybe like it, maybe don't.
Hello, I'm Jake, and this is the Maybe You Like It podcast, the podcast where we take plays, films, and more that have never been staged before, or are never likely to be staged again, and we talk about how we'd stage them. As always, I'm joined by Caleb.
Hello.
Hello, Caleb, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Did you have a good New Year, Christmas?
I had a lovely time. We had the whole Baron clan down, so it was nice.
Oh, we managed to get through our Christmas Maybe Like It party without any COVID cases, which was a small miracle, really.
Unbelievable, really. Yeah, unbelievable.
But this week, we are not alone. We are joined by an educator and stage manager, and that is Sally Garner-Gibbons. Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Yeah, all good, thank you. Lovely to see you both.
Good to see you too. Sally, maybe you could give our listeners a bit of insight into the sort of work you get up to.
Well, I wear many hats, as you said. I think I managed to fit in about three or four different jobs into one working week. But I'm mainly a stage manager in theatre, so I look after all things backstage. But in the last few years, I've moved into education, so I teach now, and I have a whole bunch of incredible young, I like to call them my stage cadets, and I'm teaching them about backstage work, so I work with them a lot. So whenever I'm doing a stage managing job, they come with me and we work together. It's really cool.
Oh, awesome. Cool. And you've brought the film this week.
Yeah.
What film have you brought us?
I have brought The Neverending Story.
and so Neverending Story was a 1984, an iconic children's classic.
Absolutely. It was a total cult film when I was a kid. I don't think we knew the word cult when we were in those days. We just knew that it was one of the most epic things we'd ever seen.
So it was directed by Wolfgang Petersen, and it was actually, at the time, it was the most expensive film ever to have been made outside of the United States or the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
So it cost $25 million and it made back $100 million at the box office, which was like huge returns, especially, you know, these days I don't even know how much that would add up to, but a lot of money basically. So it was massive.
Who does it star, Caleb?
Who does it star? It stars a bunch of kid actors, basically.
Yeah.
It stars Noah Hathaway, Barrett Oliver, Tammy Stronach, and others. So people that you might not have heard of because they've gone on to do other things.
Yeah.
Noah Hathaway, I believe, runs a tattoo parlor with his wife in California.
People come specifically to him to get tattoos from the movie.
Oh, I can imagine. I can imagine they do. He was so gorgeous. He played Atreyu. I remember his name because I used to imagine I had a boyfriend called Noah when I was that age. And he was just incredible. He was so brilliant in it. But
and he does not wear a t-shirt the entire movie.
If we're talking about sort of like 80s sensibilities to using child actors, I was reading he got three quite serious injuries during this film, one of which was during the scene where the horse drowns, which we'll get into. He was dragged underwater, and when they brought him back up, he was unconscious.
Oh my gosh.
And one of them was with the final fight with the wolf thing. He got poked in the eye and nearly lost his eye.
Oh my goodness.
In those days,
there was no such thing as health and safety.
Yeah, very different time.
Very, very different time.
We might as well bring it up now. There was also no such thing as women, apparently. There are two female speaking parts in this film. One of them is regularly called a wench. And the other is a small child and only appears in the last five minutes.
So the one who's the wench, is she one of those little gnome women? Is she the gnome?
Yes.
Oh, man. Yes. Do you know, I didn't even think about that. I just remember wanting to be the princess when I was that age.
Because her husband, the scientist, tells her to get the winch for the telescope.
Oh, yes.
He says, get the winch,
wench. Brilliant. It was also the beginnings of some excellent script writing.
Yes.
Yeah, of course. Yes.
Before we go any further, then, maybe, Sally, you could give us a rundown of the plot for those that have not had the opportunity to see The Neverending Story. Man.
Or indeed read it in German or Japanese.
So for me, it was the fact that it was a fantasy film was a really exciting thing for me as a kid, because I'd only ever really watched films about real people, and so it was just totally overwhelmingly brilliant. And I think it's part of the reason why I am quite vehemently against, not against, I just don't want much other fantasy, because I felt like this kind of set the bar for me. But essentially it's the story of a boy called Bastian, who at the beginning of the film is running away from some bullies, and to hide from them he runs into a little bookshop, little kind of finickety little bookshop, and the chap in the bookshop, who's kind of a bit odd, is reading The Neverending Story, although you don't really know it's called that yet. And Bastian kind of stays in the store while the bullies run away, and then they run away eventually, but he's kind of happy there. And then eventually he says to the bookseller, what is that book? And he said, oh, I can't tell you. It's a super secret book. It's too dangerous for you. And so Bastian, I think, buys another book and off he goes or something. But before he leaves, he manages to secrete this book in his backpack and takes it to his school, and he hides it somewhere in the school. I remember him climbing up somewhere, like in the gym or something.
It's the attic.
Oh, there you go. So he hides it in the attic, in the school
attic.
Like all schools have, right? An attic. Obviously.
I remember him, like, when I watched it a lot when I was like a very, very small, because my uncles loved it.
Yeah.
And I remembered it being that he was like, take it home, and it was set over like several weeks, and he would read it like in loads of different places. But no, it's just one day he goes up to the attic of his school and reads the entire book
there. And also, I worry about, where did his parents think he was the whole time reading his book? He didn't come home from school. Anyway, I was a bit worried. But
well, his mum's dead, because there are no women allowed in this film.
Oh, but
his dad doesn't care.
Dad doesn't care, and his brothers are fine. So he hides this book upstairs, and then, of course, he starts reading. And he kind of gets immersed in this story. So the rest of the film is about the book and the story that he's reading in the book. But it's kind of magically switches between him reading the book and then the characters in the story doing the book. And the story that he's reading, The Neverending Story, is about a young boy, obviously, as we've learned, because there are no girls, called Atreyu, who has to rescue a princess. The land that they live in is called Fantasia, and Fantasia is being taken over by a thing called the Nothing. It's like this negative, ominous force. And Atreyu has been tasked with going to find the princess, because she'll be able to save the Fantasia from the Nothing.
Is that right? He has to get a cure for her, because she's ill.
Oh, yes! Oh, my goodness, yes, that's it. And then the whole thing at the end, right? So, yeah, he has to go find a cure, because I think that's why the world is ending, and then she'll be able to stop the Nothing. And then the Nothing sends out a baddie. It's a wolf thing called Gamork, who is chasing Atreyu to try and stop him. And then the Nothing sort of takes over the land. And as Atreyu is traveling through on his beautiful horse, Artax, he comes up against all sorts of fantastical creatures. That my favourite moment in the whole film, I think, is at the beginning, when you first see the Nothing kind of taking over Fantasia. There's this magical mountain thing, creature called the Rock Biter, who eats rocks. That's how he survives. And then how he's running away from the Nothing, and these tiny little magical snail creatures are also running away from the Nothing because it's kind of encroaching on their land. But they're super speedy. Ooh, they can go so fast. And then, then it's just
racing
sort of
trails.
There you go. That's why they go so fast. It's a racing snail. it has been since the 80s since I last saw this film. So this is coming from the deep, dark depths of my memory.
I'm genuinely impressed.
I'm incredibly impressed.
Right? So there's the rock biter and then the fast snails. And then, yes, sadly, his horse dies in the swamp. And I think that was something to do with, he meets this like a turtle-like character who seems to be this wise, I think she's a woman, right? Maula? Is she a female character?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She's a woman.
A feminine,
probably.
A feminine force, but she's actually a turtle. And she gives him some advice about how to go about she sends him towards, I think, the two little gnome people. And on part of that journey, unfortunately, Artax dies. And then he gets very knackered and he gets really tired on his journey, and he's just about to sort of fade away and die. And he's rescued by the luck dragon, and all my dogs in my life since then have all looked like the luck dragon. They've all been like Falcor. He looks like a little Maltese poodle that can fly. And then the luck dragon takes him on the rest of his journey, and then the story gets a little bit lost in that they kind of now have to tell you what happens at the end of the story. And basically he goes to this place that has
an oracle.
The oracle, there you go, which is a fantastical gate place. And then he has to go and look into the gate, which actually one of them is a mirror. And then he sees Bastian, the boy who's reading the book. And the boy who's reading the book can't believe that he's in the story. And he thinks he's gone mad and he throws the book away because he's terrified. But then he can't bear it anymore because he's worried about the princess dying. So he picks the book up again and Atreyu's alive again. And then essentially Atreyu does make it to the princess who's right on the edge of Fantasia, and then nothing has just reached her tower. And she's really dying and she's poorly. And I can't remember who, but somebody says that he has to rename her in order to cure her. Is it Atreyu who says that?
It's the oracle when he gets to the oracle.
Oh, the oracle, right. You've got to find a new name.
A human child needs to rename
the Empress. There you go. And then Bastian realises that's him, and then he's too scared to do it, but then he does do it, and he shouts out the window. And I never knew what he shouted out the window, because he says it so loud and so quickly that it never registered for me what her name was. But I since learned that it's Moonchild. So
apparently it's Moonchild in the book, but in the film it's his mother's name, and it's on purpose that you can't hear what his mum's name is.
Oh.
Apparently.
Wow, you have done your research. There you go. So he shouts out Moonchild, and that's maybe why I never knew what it was. And then that's it. Then she's fine. And then Bastian somehow ends up riding the luck dragon and knocks the bullies over into a big dumpster. The end.
Yeah, I mean, basically the idea is that at the end he gets to rebuild Fantasia from his own thoughts and ideas.
Yeah, so Fantasia is ultimately
his imagination.
Like, that's right, yeah. So Fantasia is ultimately imagination, and the idea of the never-ending story is that the story is now his, and he can see the story from his perspective, and then it carries on and carries on and carries on. And the reason I loved it was, the reason I like the idea of staging it is because it doesn't matter that it's not the most brilliant story with the most clever ending, but it's epic. It's totally epic. And it just lends itself so brilliantly to being a play.
And I think as well, like as a piece of, you know, like family theatre that is open and accessible to all, it has that sort of inspirational thing of like like you say, the point is that it's a story about how great storytelling is and how fun it is to make up your own stories. Yeah. And that as a piece of theatre is really exciting, because it's like, here's us showing you a story, but you can make up your own story. Yeah. And that's really cool.
And as a feminist, I think I don't feel like it's a boy rescuing a princess. I feel like it's children using their imagination to kind of pave their way. So I really like that as a story.
Absolutely,
kind of
arc.
There's two plot things I think that might come up later that I'll mention now.
Okay.
One is that there's one moment where the princess, when she's trying to get the boy to call out the name, explains to the, what's the warrior called?
Atreyu.
Explains to Atreyu that as well as the boy reading the book, there are also some people watching the film that the boy is in, and that he doesn't know that either. And then he sort of the voice sort of looks around a little bit.
But then
they just never bring it up again. That's it.
That's me. I was the guy watching the film.
Also, just to mention, because I just love it. I don't love it, but it's great and terrible at the same time. Atreyu drowns because the swamp is like a swamp of misery.
Uh-huh.
It's called the Deadly Swamp of Sadness.
Okay.
And the horse gets sad, and that's why he dies.
I remember
but
that.
But there's just no reason given then, why the horse gets sad. Yeah,
then the thing that I found really weird was that, and then obviously because his horse has died, Atreyu gets really sad, but he's fine.
He doesn't drown in the swamp of sorrow. Look, it doesn't have to make sense.
No, it doesn't.
Absolutely, it
does. But I remember that. I remember that, and I have to say, I would say 90% of the time, whenever I'm swimming, I'm imagining that I am Atreyu and I'm screaming out for Artax in the water. And I still do that now as a grand old age of 45. I'm still imagining my horse drowning.
Let's move into staging it then.
Yeah.
Sally, did you have any sort of like thoughts of like, you know, just coming from like a broad concept of how you would begin to stage this?
Well, of course.
Of course.
So I feel, so one of the styles of theatre that I love, that I've worked on a lot over the years, that I really, really love, is I love site-specific and open-air theatre. I think that's really, really exciting. So I think this would make a really brilliant film, if it, a play rather, if it was staged outdoors as a kind of promenade piece. So each of the story sections could be set up somewhere, but could be particularly beautiful and almost like the world that you create for the audience is Fantasia. So, you know, there could be a foyer area where there's a little bit of the nothingness creeping in, and then, yeah, and then you go on the journey, that the audience kind of go on the same journey that Atreyu goes on.
Do you have a like specific site in mind, or is this more general than that?
What a good question. No, I don't have a particular site in mind. I mean, anywhere that you could have the landscape that the film suits, I think. So somewhere where there's where there's maybe a couple of little hills, maybe some forest and woodland, a little bit of water.
Well, I was just thinking about Jake and I have both visited a theatre in Keswick in the Lake District called Theatre by the Lake.
Oh, I know it. And I know it well.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Well, I mean, I can imagine doing something out of there, right?
Man,
and you could
go
around the lake and up a hill near there. And
that's perfect. And the wonderful thing about that lake, I've actually walked... What lake is that? Is it Windermere?
That is Derwent Water, I think.
Right. So I've definitely walked around it, because we visited some friends who were working at the Theatre on the Lake only a few years ago. And the thing that was remarkable about that area was that the landscape changes, actually, as you walk around. So there's some kind of boggy, swampy areas, and then there's some beautiful green, lushy hillsides. And it was, that would be amazing there.
Brilliant. Well, there's our setting then.
Perfect. Love it.
Well, Caleb, did you have any different initial idea? We haven't for a while, because we're so boring. We haven't talked about our own ideas, but
I mean, to be honest, my first thought went to, which is my idea is boring, because my first thought just went to like, okay, like big, like theater, like in a big proscenium arch theater, lots of crazy puppets, like we build like a 16 foot 20 foot tall rock monster, like we do all the gizmos and gadgets, and all the fun stuff. But I actually think you know, picking out that idea about like the never ending story is about like us inventing the story, and us, you know, the only reason the story exists is because we're experiencing it. I actually think site specific, therefore, is way more interesting, because you're in a space, but you all of the fancy elements you're placing onto that space with your own imagination. And I think that's way more exciting.
I really like the idea that the audience is kind of immersed in it as well. So, you know, the idea of running away from the nothing feels to me like it could be a really big element of it. And I did an open air piece in Chichester a few years ago called Crossing Lines. It was in the city of Chichester, and it was a promenade piece, so that we walked around the city, but the audience, in order to ensure that only they were hearing what was happening and we didn't pick up members of the public, the company all had microphones on, and the audience wore headphones, a bit like a silent disco. So whatever was being said, the audience could hear through their headphones. So if they were part of a long crowd of people, they could still hear at the back what was being said. It was really brilliant. And I feel like with something like this, we could do a similar experience. So the audience could have headphones on, and we could be playing in sounds of the nothing, you know, rumbling from behind, and the audience could be escaping. So a little bit like, you know, when the racing snails do their race, or when the rock biter is kind of, you know, marching through, you can always, the audience could be part of that process, could be hiding behind things and trying to escape themselves.
I think that's awesome. I think as well, it gives you the opportunity to sort of, I guess, cover up maybe what you can't create. What, like, you know, you could create a huge rock biter puppet, but it can't then also move about loads of places.
Yeah.
So you can kind of add that in through sound design as well.
Yeah.
And also, yeah, having the you know, being chased by the nothing is a great way of just being able to move your audience from place to place without much effort.
Yeah.
Because you just say, oh, we've got to get away from the nothing, and then you run to the next place, which is, I think that's really neat as well.
The rock biter to me feels like a character that is, it is in a fixed position, but it has more than one person involved in puppeteering it. So, you know, it would be so big that it would take sort of 8 or 9 people to puppeteer the rock biter.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. I love the thing it has that is basically a Segway, but like made of rocks.
Yeah.
Like that's how it moves around.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, right?
Absolutely love it.
I had not made that connection in my mind that it's basically a rock Segway. That's so good. What's great as well about the Rock Biter actually is you have him introduced at the beginning of the Never Ending Story, and then he comes back later in this sort of like tragic, you know, 11th hour moment with the hero,
yeah.
Where he's sort of like egging Atreyu on to like, you know, complete his quest. You can have that happen in the same place, I think.
Yeah, you can come back around again.
Exactly, and it can be like another moment with the puppet, and yeah, you kind of have that opportunity. I guess you have the opportunity, right, of like, the site specific is great because it immerses the audience, but it also, like, I guess as I already mentioned, like we can place whatever we want onto that as well in the moment,
yeah.
And it can just be like, okay, now it's this, and then we come back around and we're like, okay, we're in the same place, but it's actually this place now instead. And I think people are willing to go along with that because they feel part of the action when they're in a site specific show anyway.
But the thing that I've learned over the years about audiences is they will believe whatever you tell them. You don't have to, nothing has to be realistic, nothing has to appear as it is in the text even. You know, if you as a theatre creator are making a world, I don't know, this playwright has written about a world that, you know, is in someone's house, but you've created it out of bubbles and fluffy clouds. As long as you're telling the audience, this is it, this is the room that we are supposed to be in, the audience will totally believe you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I think I completely agree with that. I think also I would be really keen, because we could, there's a version of this where we just cut away everything and it becomes like one quest, we meet two characters.
Yeah.
Maybe it's, you know, yeah, as you say, like I think this is, cries out for puppets, and the design is probably the best thing about the film. It's just incredible to look at, even now.
Yeah, I don't think it's a moral life lesson that it hoped it would be all those years ago. You know, I don't think it's trying to tell us anything about, you know, it's not an indictment on human nature or anything like that, although I think it wants to be. It's just saying, use your imagination, have a bit of fun. And I think theatre is the best place in the world for that.
Yeah,
it does, because it tries to sort of do the Peter Pan thing of like, no one believes in magic anymore, but it doesn't quite do it.
No.
But no, I was going to say that the thing that, like, the most impressive part of like the story structure to me is that, like, that rock character and the snails and the bat that we see at the beginning as
the
like
bat!
Sort of this sort of
the little old man.
The little old man and the bat. We see
we see
them as like the standard, like, for beginning of a film expositional characters that may not necessarily die, but they introduce you to the story and then they leave, and then we're following someone else. But then the fact that then later we come back and we hear about they've had their own story while we've been gone, I love that as like a creating a big world where lots of things continue to happen.
Yeah,
is there an opportunity here then, perhaps, and maybe this is a little over ambitious, but where actually you don't have to follow Atreyu as an audience member, but you can choose who to follow. Like, because we have this opening with the creatures and the rock biter, and then we go to the palace and Atreyu is being given his quest. What if at that point, from there, you can follow Atreyu, or you can follow the people we're already speaking to, or there's even a setup of another plot and you could follow that, and they all spread out across this area and there's lots of different plots and they interact with each other and then also come back together.
This brings me to my big question, which is, this is a kids' film.
Yeah.
Is our play aimed at kids? Because I think that's the way to answer your question, Caleb. I think if this is a kids' play, then we want to follow one kid on their quest, and we want to meet the characters and the puppets and have fun with them and really feel immersed in the story as the people on the quest.
Well,
if it's not for kids, then Sally's going to disagree with me anyway, so I'm going to stop.
No, I've got it. I think you're right. I think it is for kids, but I think it's a family play, because I think it's one of those plays where you can give such nuance to the characters, like all of them, really, and they can have some adult themes to them that only the adults will get, and I think they'll enjoy the story. I love the idea of it being almost like a choose-your-own-adventure story, which would be amazing. And in fact, that is almost exactly what we did with Crossing Lines. I keep going back to that play. It was one of the most amazing kind of theatrical experiences, I think, that I got to work on. But we did exactly that. So we split the audience into three, and there were three journeys. Yeah. But each of the three journeys that you went on all eventually went through the same... They all saw the same plot of the story, just at different times. And then we had to meet at the end for a big finale, which was amazing. Timing, it was so complicated. But what I'd imagined with this is I love that idea of those worlds don't stop when you've left that part of the promenade or wherever you are in the story. So I'd sort of imagined that we'd have an interval, and I imagined that the interval would kind of be around about the time that he gets to the oracle. Now, I know that feels like almost at the end of the story, but I love the idea of leaving the audience with him seeing the boy in the mirror. I think that's such a brilliant moment. And then the end of it is all the other weird bits that you have to tie up, and then it's the end, and then it's the remaking of his own story. But it, during the interval, the audience will come back to wherever they started, I would imagine, to buy their drinks and their popcorn. And the foyer will have changed slightly, like the nothing will have got to the foyer. So when they arrive, maybe it's very, very beautiful and like little nods to the nothing. But when they get to the foyer, the nothing has destroyed the foyer, let's say. So it's already dark. But then they can wander around a bit. And when they wander around, they can go back and see the rock biter and go and have, you know, sit and have a little picnic at the foot of the rock biter, or go and see where, go back to the water where Artax drowned. I mean, that doesn't sound brilliant, but you know, or go into the little gnome's house, or even kind of sit on the luck dragon and go meet Falcor. Yeah. And then they meet again and they carry on the journey from the Oracle after that.
I really love that. I think as well, if that's where you place the interval, which I think's really a neat place to do it, and I agree, like, although it's quite far on in where the way the film does it, actually there's a lot more you could do with that second half, and actually you could make it much shorter. I guess I think you could have these separate storylines that all find their way back to Atreyu. So like one of them could be like, you know, that the knight that he sees get killed by the sphinxes. Like, what if you followed the knight on his quest, and then you get to the sphinxes, and then the knight gets killed, and you're like, what? And then Atreyu just comes in, and you're like, oh, we're joining Atreyu's story again, and Atreyu is here, nice. And Atreyu makes it through the sphinxes. I think that, and again, the rock biter, like, if you followed the rock biter and his friends, and then they get taken by the nothing, and then you're left there, and then Atreyu meets the rock biter, and you're like, oh, now we have another story that we can join, and it's the hero's story. And I think as well that gives a sense that there's all these other stories and this whole world going on, but also they're getting smaller and smaller as it goes along, because the nothing is like encroaching further and further into Phantasia. So I think that means that the second act, which will be shorter, the whole audience is together for it, and that's when we get the real like meaty plot stuff and the important stuff.
Yeah, and I'm a huge fan of a short act two, big fan of a very short act two. In fact, I'm quite a big fan of a one actor.
So are we.
I'm very into that idea that we see the majority of the story, we've learned as much as we can at the beginning, and then the second half is just a 30-35 minute roundup of where we were and kind of fulfilling everybody's dreams and then moving on.
Absolutely.
Well, so you mentioned the mirror and then that being the point of the interval.
If
we're doing this sort of in, I don't know how immersive we're making it, are we just watching? I'll get to my question. So I have all these kind of questions about like how immersive it is, and essentially like what I think is really unique, at least about the book, which I haven't read, but from what I've read, the book is like the film, but focuses more on this relationship between the kid and the world. What's interesting about it in a certain way is the way that, you know, he cries out no when the horse dies, and the people in the characters in the story hear him, and he's seen in the mirror, and then of course at the end the whole idea is that he has to call out this name, which is funny that it's such a like a low effort task, this makes such a big deal out of it anyway. And this idea that like, oh, the quest is actually kind of pointless in that he was with the princess to start with, Atreyu, but the idea is that he has to go on the quest to draw the boy into the story so that he cares, and all this kind of stuff. And I really like all of those themes. And the question is, in this version, do we have a little boy? I've not seen Starlight Express, but my understanding is that's sort of what it is, where it's a musical where a kid is like reading a book and then the play happens, that's kind of the only time we care. Is it like that, where like there's just a boy that's reading a book, and then like occasionally we'll see him because he pops into the story because he has control over it? Or do we sort of twist it more and give the audience that are actually watching this performance that agency somehow and bring them to it?
I think we should make it like the Neverending Story. So the boy who plays Bastian is reading the book, and that's the story that he's seeing, you know, unfold in front of his eyes. And maybe it isn't a book. Maybe he's making a film of it or something. So when he lifts his camera up, that's when the stories begin. I don't know. I'm spitballing here. But I think we as the audience, then we are watching him. So when the audience interact with the piece in some way, maybe they do gasp, or maybe they say, oh no, or, you know, they do that kind of almost pantomime thing of he's behind you. only he, only Bastien, he is the audience. Only Bastien notices, you know, or if somebody brushes past him, rather than the characters in the story. And then it becomes who's watching them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. That is, I like that. I think in terms of that, like, opening, there's even maybe an opportunity of, if you're doing it at Theatre by the Lake, of like starting it in the theatre and ending it in the theatre.
Yeah.
And so we're like seeing the boy, like, we could have him reading the book, and it's like it starts like it's a normal stage play, and then it goes outside and it becomes this whole other world.
Well, there's a great theatrical trick that we have to do in order to show when Atreyu looks in the mirror, we have to see Bastien. And you can do that with a very famous theatrical trick called Pepper's Ghost.
Of course.
Right. So, but you can only do that in a pros theatre. You can only do that in a pros theatre where you can hide things in the wings, and you've got a mirror and a trapdoor and stuff. So what I've been thinking all the time is, how are we going to do the Pepper's Ghost thing? Which is when we'll make, as soon as Atreyu looks at the mirror, there is a 3D version of Bastien standing there. But Bastien isn't, because we can see Bastien somewhere else. We know that he's in a different part of the building. So, we have to do that in the theatre. So that's a brilliant idea. That's a solve.
Yeah.
So we'll do Pepper's Ghost maybe in the Theatre of the Lake.
I was going to say, you could even do like the entrance with the sphinxes and like that challenge is the entrance to the theatre or something like that. And that, and so we find a natural route in. Yes. And the Oracle is the theatre.
Oh, and that's got like a triple double meaning.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Hey, that's so good.
I love that. I think that's great.
So, are there several Bastiens when we split up? Do we each follow our own Bastien, or maybe not a Bastien, but someone else reading the story? Or
potentially.
See, that's what I was thinking about. Right, is either we follow several Bastiens, or if we've started all together with a Bastien and we've got to know his like basic story.
He's called Bastien because he's the Bastien of Hope.
Whoa! Mind blown.
So if we started with Bastien and we've got like the basic understanding of who he is and what his story is, and then we're like let loose in Fantasia, and then we're brought back together for that moment where Bastien is realizing that he's like part of the story and Atreyu is seeing Bastien, I kind of think that's maybe enough for most of the audience to kind of get it, in that like you don't necessarily have to follow Bastien all of the rest of the time. Like, I think if you're following Atreyu's story, you're following Bastien. But maybe these other separate stories aren't following Bastien, but you know about him. You know he's reading the book with you, and then you're going to see him again when you get to the end of the second act, the end of the first act anyway. And then all of the second act, you're going to be with him anyway, because we're all going to be together for that. So I think there's kind of enough of Bastien that you could kind of get away with not having him in all the sort of subplots as well.
Do you think?
Yeah, and
Do you think we give copies of the never-ending story to members of the audience when we leave the Bastien, our Bastien? Does one group of people have a young person at the front of their group who has the never-ending story book, so they don't have to do anything with it, it's just a symbol, but then we're following that boy's or that child's journey into that part of the story, and then somebody else gets a copy of the never-ending story and they are the young person going on the other journey.
I think that's a really, really neat way of handling
it. Maybe it has just little instructions in it, like go to the thing.
Follow the green rabbit. Ribbon. Your journey follows the green ribbons or something. So so at least they can do that journey.
I guess that's making me think about like sort of how big an audience do you think the sort of capacity for this would be? How big does it get before it stops working?
Well, look here. You have to decide whether making a profit is important to you.
Well, we have an unlimited budget on this podcast, so it doesn't matter.
So if I was a producer talking, I would say as many people as possible so that we can sell as many tickets.
Yes.
I feel, though, that, and from my experience in Promenade Theatre, it gets crowded very quickly. So the more people you have in an outdoor space, the more they push against each other and try to be in the front row. And then anybody further back tends to get lost a little, and the most of the scene is about them jumping up and down to kind of see if they can hear things or see things. So I think the smaller the audience, the better. It becomes more intimate and more, you know, I don't know, it's a bit more of an inspired piece of work then, because you can hear and feel everything. So I would say you would want a small group of people with each journey, maybe 10 or 15 people max.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, let's say we did 3 or maybe 4 journeys, you're then looking at like, you know, a decent audience size
60.
Of like 45, 60 by the time we get back together. Yeah. So that's kind of, you know, it's not a bad size.
You could even do some things like if the second act only has like two of the characters in, you could have like two Atreus and two whatever else is in the second act, and then everyone else could like be starting the first act again, and you could do two performances and like overlapping each other and get movies in that way.
I mean, practically you have to be careful with sound, because you don't want to be playing the rock biter when you're trying to do an intimate scene at the end.
I was gonna say it could be the Neverending Story, the audiobook. And everyone's got it in their headphones.
Yeah.
I've just got the how do we make money out of this hat on right now. But I'll put it away in a minute. I mean, to be honest, the puppets for this would cost, I think, millions.
Yeah, the budget is going to go out the window on puppets, I'm afraid. I mean, Falcor, I want Falcor to fly, and doing flying outdoors, I don't think has ever been done unless you use an actual aeroplane or helicopter.
So. There's a bit where he flies through space.
Yeah, so that's going to be expensive.
So we get the rocket ship out.
Every day, every single performance, we get someone to do like a halo jump from the edge of space and fly
in. Jeff Bezos.
In a dragon,
guy's name? Costume. Was it Baumgartner? What was his name? The guy who jumped out of space.
Oh, on the balloon?
No, the guy who free jumped.
Oh, the Virgin thing.
Yeah, what was his name? Was it Baumgartner?
Been, I don't know.
Yeah. We just get someone to do that, and they have to start at the half, and then how long does it take, like an hour or something, to fall to Earth?
I love that as an idea.
Baumgartner, you're right.
That's there you go.
I don't know where that came from. And then, but he has to be dressed as the Luck Dragon.
As a dragon, yeah.
Yeah.
That's our introduction to the dragon.
The Neverending Story, Let Loose in Fantasia, starring Felix Baumgartner. That's the story. That sells.
That sells. I thought the Luck Dragon was quite strange in its introduction.
It's iconic.
Brilliant.
Oh, because in the book, Caleb, in the book, we meet him much earlier than that.
No, but as in the scene, so the Luck Dragon picks up Atreyu and like takes him, and then like the scene where Atreyu like wakes up. Did you not, Jake, you watched this recently.
Yeah.
Did you not find the dialogue very strange?
The dialogue throughout is really strange.
Yeah, because he's like, to me, that scene where he's like tickling behind his ear, iconic. I remembered that scene vividly from when I watched it as a kid.
Didn't you want to tickle him behind the ears?
Yeah, please scratch my ear. He's so sweet. But I do know what you mean, Caleb. For me, it's slightly odd because he just appears out of nowhere and is like, hello, I'm the Luck Dragon. I've come to save you with the opportunity. It's because in the book, there's like a whole fight that they skip in the film that involves the Luck Dragon.
Oh.
And that's why he sort of appears out of nowhere in this one.
It's strange.
But there's a lot of that, like, Artax, the horse that we get really sad about, and we see the kid reading the book is a much better actor than the kid in the quest, in my opinion.
Totally.
The kid reading the book is like, oh my God, he's so upset. He's crying his eyes out.
Yeah.
But, like, in film runtime, between us meeting the horse and the horse dying, there is less than 2 minutes.
Yeah. But we do love that horse.
That's why it's such a kid's film to me, because I remember when I was a kid, like, feeling really emotional. I remember it being, because it's called The Neverending Story, I remember it being really long.
Yeah, forever.
Oh, that's something else I wanted to mention, actually. The reason why I think that is because it sort of doesn't do any film stuff, in that it doesn't skip time. It doesn't do, like, when the kid's getting the book out, like, if it was like a Hot Fuzz or something, you'd, like see one shot of him pulling the book, one shot of him lighting a candle, and then he'd be reading the book. But this thing, this film, you get a 2 minute shot and you see him do all of it in real time. But to me, it's like, it makes it quite slow, but you feel like you're reading a book because it's sort of all happening.
It's deliberate.
And slow and happening in real time, which I think is really nice.
That does
and lends itself well to theatre.
I guess a slightly boring practical question of, we already talked about the many injuries that Noah Hathaway got whilst filming this. Do we cast Atreyu a bit older? Do we get like a young looking adult actor? Because I can't imagine like trying to do all the paperwork for a child actor to ride a horse every single day as part of this play or something.
Well, actually having a horse in this thing?
No, the horse is a puppet. For sure the horse is a puppet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
right.
They're gonna I mean, we're not gonna use the war horse style, but the puppet will be puppeteered by four or five puppeteers, and the boy will sit comfortably on his back, you know, like we did in Running Wild. So health and safety should be fine with that, but I quite like the idea of the boy who's reading the book and whoever Atreyu is, I don't know if Atreyu needs to be a boy, could be a similar age, so that they're really, you know, for me in the film, there's appear very different ages, and I always found that, I struggled with that when I watched it as a child. I said I couldn't understand why Atreyu was so old. Yeah. But he was only 15 or 16.
Well, yeah, when I watched, they look the same age, but maybe that's just like watching
it. I remember them being the same actor. When I watched it just now, but when I was remembering it before I watched it, I remember, because he sort of is, that's why when he like shows his true self, he sees the boy, they sort of are reflections of each other, and they do look quite similar. They've both got the sort of 80s curtains haircut. Yeah. I thought they were the same kid.
Oh no, I always imagined that. I think I was, when was it? It was in 1984.
Yeah.
Is that when it, so when did it come out as a film? It must have been, what, 87, 88?
No, that's when it came out as a film.
The film was 84.
The book's like 79, 78.
Oh no, I must have been, so I was, no, I can't possibly, how old was that? That makes me seven. No, I must have been older but it when
was,
I watched
the thing is, I think, well, at the time of VHSs and other, like, you know, non-streaming services, films would be big for longer.
That's true, like, and also you wouldn't see them for a year sometimes after they'd been in the cinema. So,
I also think the UK release was quite a bit later than the US.
I'm imagining
release
that
as well.
I was about 11 actually the first time I saw it, and I identified with Bastian. I felt like I was very similar age to him. Like I must have been just a little bit younger. And that the boy who played Atreyu was much much older, which is why I like to pretend he was my boyfriend, because I thought he was 15.
It's really funny. His, the actor's Wikipedia page says former actor and teen idol.
Yeah, you see? Teen idol, definitely.
Teen idol.
Which he has an even better job. What's the guy that's not a tattoo, he also has a wild and amazing job.
What does he do?
Yeah, he's a photographer.
Oh, very cool.
But not just, basically what he is he, not what he is, but what he's, what it seems to have done is that he made so much money being a child actor that now he just gets to do, like, obviously, like, professional photographer is a very respectable profession, but he does very specifically, like, 19th century style photography.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Like, he, like, it's like a really particular art form.
Like, with the, like, big, like, plates and, and, like, Oh, that's so cool. Oh, wow.
So, yeah, two very cool
that's
jobs.
That's so funky that there's... well, given as well, like, what happened to some child actors of that,
that
generation. It's pretty much the best way it could go. Cool, okay. What else is there to talk about? I feel like we've covered a lot.
So much, yet so little.
I feel like we've definitely covered a lot.
That's always the way.
I feel like, first of all, somebody should definitely have done this by now. Because it's
such an amazing
story. And it's just such an epic piece of theatre. It's just, you know, when you look at all the kind of musicals that are being made at the moment, like I'm thinking of Back to the Future, which actually when I was told about this podcast, first of all, that was the first thing that came to my mind. I was like, of course it's got to be Back to the Future. And I was like, oh, no, they've already done that.
I think we literally had a conversation about doing Back to the Future, like, and then, like, a week later, they announced it was coming to the West End.
I mean, it's the most obvious choice for a musical. But, and then I thought The Neverending Story, it's got to be, because it is just so big and so exciting. And because there's no real story, you don't have to be stuck in the words. It can all be about the spectacle, and that's what I really love. And, of course, I think the cast should be majority of young people, I think that's what makes outdoor theatre for families magical, is when young people are the performers too.
Yeah. Well, and obviously you've had lots of experience of working in those. I mean, Running Wild was all young people in its first iteration.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, maybe you could explain a bit more about what Running Wild was.
Yeah, so Running Wild was a Michael Morpurgo book based on a true story, in fact. Well, based on a news article that Michael Morpurgo read about the tsunami in 2004?
Four. Boxing Day tsunami.
2004, yeah. And he read a newspaper article about a child who had been riding an elephant along the beach. And then when this, just before the tsunami hit, in fact, I think it was even a couple of hours before, this elephant just ran off into the hills and everybody was terrified and they thought the elephant had absconded with this child. And then 2 hours later, the tsunami hit. And actually, the child was okay. The child survived because the elephant ran off and actually managed to escape the worst of it. And so he wrote this play called Running Wild, which is a story about a child who's on the beach and an elephant runs off into the woods before a tsunami hits. But actually, the story carries on and he meets orangutans and he lives in the woods. And it's just a really wonderful story. And then eventually he travels through the woods and he comes to a sanctuary for orangutans and he learns about the dangers of using palm oil and how that destroys the environment of orangutans, which, you know, it's good to have a moral at the end of the story, but that was a bit incongruous for me. Anyway, but it was a beautifully told story, and we did it with puppets, and we had an incredible young actor playing the lead role, who was just the most extraordinary young performer. And we had this life-size elephant. The elephant's name was Una in the story. And there were one, two, three, four puppeteers moving this elephant, one person inside the body, one person inside the head, and then another person on the legs. It was incredible. And then there were puppeteers doing the orangutans, and it was just a magical story. And the cast were all young people, just really brilliant.
Well, and actually, previous guest on the podcast, Fred Davies,
was one of the puppeteers.
One of the orangutan puppeteers.
He was, and Fred is just, he's extraordinary, Fred.
Yeah, we had him on back in, that podcast episode was in October, doing Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah. Great, what a good one. Yeah, it's people like Fred who really are inspiring to me, actually, because Fred, you know, he became a puppeteer through doing the youth theatre shows, just because he was strong and intelligent and he kind of really understood performance. And so, I don't know, somebody saw a spark in him and said, why don't you try some puppeteering? And now that's what he does for a living, and he's just brilliant at it. Yeah,
absolutely. That's awesome. And so, yeah, definitely, I think the idea of making this a production using a young company is like a really exciting way of, like you say as well, like just bringing to life this, like the excitement of the storytelling and the like energy and the like youth that is already inherent in the story. I think that's really cool.
And I think that the story is about young people's imagination. I think that is ultimately what the Neverending Story is about. And that's why the princess and Atreyu and Bastien are all children. You know, Atreyu and the princess could be adults. They could be a grown-up adventurer and a grown-up princess, but they're not. They're all children. And I remember watching it when I was young, thinking, well, that's funny that the princess is so little. You know, I couldn't understand why she was a child. But I get it now, because it's all about kids. It's all about the imagination and the incredible open positivity that young people have before they find out what the real world is like. Well,
her official credited character name is Childlike Empress, which I think is weird.
Childlike Empress,
Yeah, I mean, and also I think as well, in terms of when you're a child, you can put so much emotion into these characters. The puppets aren't like, they're beautiful, but they're not very expressive, actually. There's one very funny shot to me. It's a sequence, actually, where it's a bit like the end of Avengers Endgame, when Thanos realizes that he doesn't have the stones, and it like cuts back and forth between the reaction and then the other thing that's happening, and what he's looking at. Reaction, other thing, other something. And in the film, it's, you see the nothing is coming, and the rock biter is like reacting to the nothing coming. Do you remember this scene, Caleb? Have you seen it recently?
Yeah, it's
very funny, because it's two shots, one of just like a tree in the wind, because that's what the nothing actually is when you like actually look at what they've
filmed. Yeah, it's not really a thing,
And then one is this very unexpressive puppet, and the camera's just zooming in on it, and it's just mouth agape. There's just nothing going on, and it's so funny. It's just like tree zoom. It's only about 6 minutes in. It's brilliant. But when you're a kid, you just put that emotion on top of it.
Definitely.
And like puppets nowadays in theatre are incredibly expressive.
Oh,
and
they're awesome.
Use the actors to bring expression to it as well. And so I actually feel like there's almost another level you can bring to it.
Well, I really struggled. I don't know if I said this to you earlier, but when I tried to show the film to my children, I think I first tried to show it to my son, maybe 12, 15 years ago, I really struggled to watch it, because actually, it's awful. The puppetry's dreadful, and the special effects are really clunky and old fashioned, and you can see where everything's cut and paced together, and I just watched it going, how did I believe that, you know? Whereas when I was a kid, it was so real. It was just everything was real. I was terrified of the nothing, and I remember Gamork being absolutely petrifying. Like, I couldn't bear to watch him when he was on screen. But then when you see it again now, it's just a wolf.
It's like a funny stop motion thing as well. Yeah.
So I think we could do a better job of it now. I think with all the magic that we can create in theatre, and how masterful puppetry is, and there are some puppet makers who I've worked with over the years, you know, Nick Barnes and Charlie Timms and Toby Ollier, who are just extraordinary. And they could, oh my goodness, they could create this world which would be far beyond anything you could imagine yourself. They're just brilliant.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And even get like Yeah, and sorry, I'm just thinking of other special effects that we could probably do better than they do in this film. Like the little people, there's like the scientist and the wench, I'm doing quotes, who he meets, and they're very small. They're supposed to be like the size of his hand or
really
something.
Really teeny weeny,
except only in some shots. Like only sometimes. And there's one shot where the woman gives him a cup. And the cup is the same size in her hand as it is in his.
Oh, like, brilliant.
I'm like, come on, guys.
It should be
just a little bit more effort. And also they do that thing where like the other person is just further away, so they look smaller. Yeah. But they don't achieve it at all. Clever. He just looks like he's further away. Like, it's brilliant. And I'm like, I think we could do that better. And I don't even need to talk about what, like how, like we'll just do that better.
We could definitely do that better.
But no, I think, I mean, considering when it comes, I think it's a brilliant attempt.
I think there's some was saying to Jake before we start recording, I think there's some really cool stuff in it where like there was a time where you could just like paint, you could just like get your shot of like the set and then you could just paint around it, like, you know, physically like animate around it, and people would just accept that, and actually like in a way it although it's very stylized, I think it looks better than a lot of the like CG shots we'll get now. Because, like, now we've decided, oh, no, it has to be computer-generated and it has to look as realistic as possible. If you don't have the budget to back that up, it just looks like a rubbery CG awful model, right?
Yeah.
And actually, to have done something that, like, if you did this now, but as a choice of, like, stylized, like, painted that look to it, I think that's like a really cool
I love the sound of that.
you don't have that anymore on film. I just think it's you could incorporate that into a stage show. I am thinking like you could put up like you know although you could be in a woodlands and stuff, you could like put up these huge painted backdrops as well to like hide the road that's
definitely
behind it or whatever.
Well,
I
love do you love Wes Anderson films, the beautiful kind of, I don't know how he does it, the most incredible kind of colour palette in every scene and in every moment. There's little nuance and touches to that. And I think we could do that. We could paint the scenery, but with a very beautiful stylized approach so that every place you went, you knew you were still in the same story. But it doesn't have to be real. You know, it doesn't have to be hyper real, at least. It could be our imagination.
It's fantasy.
Yeah, it is
fantasy.
And that's the other thing, the thing that's strangely refreshing for such an old film, because I think we sort of seem to have decided now that like Lewis and Tolkien invented fantasy and Rowling and Kevin Feige perfected it, and there's sort of not much else. And so it's like really refreshing actually to watch a film with characters in it that I actually hadn't seen before. But not for a long time.
And I thought it was neat because it there's a line like right towards the beginning with the weird bookshop guy where he's like, you know, he's asking like Bastian if he's read books before, and he's like, oh, you know, I've read Wizard of Oz and Lord of the Rings and stuff. And the guy's like, oh, well, this ain't Lord of the Rings. This is way crazier than that. And I thought it was neat because it says like, oh, this is your sort of cultural starting point, and this is what like where we've taken it. And there is sort of like an acknowledgement of like, the film owes something to like the work of Tolkien and what's come before, but it does take it to a completely different place. Like the idea of the nothing is such a wacky idea, like, and an idea that I would say like would be considered like a bit like too meta and a bit too weird even for like today's audiences. I think that's like really, there's something about that as well. Like you say, Jake, like coming out of 1984, that's like, quite a neat piece of storytelling, I guess.
The nothing to me is absolutely that coming of age thing where you stop believing in fairies.
That's
what it is. It's the moment where you turn 15 and you're way too cool to believe that, you know, I don't know, a hobbit was roaming across a mountaintop, or you know, Darth Vader has an errant child. You know, you just kind of go, that's not cool anymore. And that's exactly what the nothing is. The nothing is saying, if you stop imagining, if you stop having fun, if you stop being a child, then what point is there to everything? There's no point.
Yes,
that's what it always meant to me anyway. Sorry about that, guys. Yeah, so sad.
And actually, that actually gave me a bit of hope, actually, that the bookkeeper in a 1984 movie was going, kids these days don't like books, they're all on their bleaty bleaty book boots. And I was like, that hasn't changed in 40 years.
No, it hasn't.
People still say that.
Yeah, kids these days, exactly.
Yeah. Bro, I think, to be honest, I think that might bring us to the end of this conversation. As we always say, Sally, that this is kind of like the first hour of like how a conversation would begin about these shows. You know, you talk about all the big ideas, and then it would be hours and hours and hours afterwards to actually make any of those things happen.
And it's getting millions and millions of dollars.
We gotta get some good funding in place for this one.
Yeah, absolutely. But thank you so much for coming on and chatting about this. I really enjoyed watching the film because I'd never seen it.
I'm really glad you did.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's definitely, you know, it's not a perfect film, but there's definitely there's a lot to love about it though, and I think some of the design is really, really cool. Yeah. And some of that stuff we talked about with the story about how it's sort of this really sincere, like, you know, celebration of imagination. Yeah. You don't get that anymore. I think that's really cool.
Sally, tell us, what are you up to at the moment? I hesitate to ask that in our Omicron riddled world.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have some social media or internet that people can reach you on to find out more about your work? This is your soapbox.
Well, I'm not very active on the socials, only because nobody would be really interested in what I have to say about the world. Mostly my social media is about my family and my running hobby. I've just finished doing Pinocchio at the Chichester Festival Theatre, where I was the stage manager. And we managed to avoid Omicron. We were very, very fortunate. We got through the whole run. Only one cast member missed 10 days of the run, sadly, for COVID. But everybody else managed to keep it at bay, which was brilliant. And that's what I do every Christmas. I spend every Christmas, every year, and have done for the last 20-something years at the Chichester Theatre. And now I'm back at the college, training up the next year's stage crew. I really love it. I'm really lucky to work with some incredible young technicians and send them out into the world. You know, my favourite thing is hearing back from technicians who have gone into the business and are loving it and living it and, you know, just having the life that I had when I was their age in my 20s, so it was brilliant.
And I would say, having been stage managed by you for a youth theatre production, just how great it is to have someone who has, yeah, that like incredible experience and is so caring about and passionate about young people making theatre. Definitely something I appreciated at the time.
Okay, and I know lovely.
Other people at the time would have. And thank you for coming and talking on my podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and how lovely to see you. Yeah, and it's so great that you're still talking about theatre. You know, that's why I love it. That's why I love being at the beginning of people discovering this incredible world, because it is the most amazing life. You know, we're never going to be millionaires working in theatre, but I tell you, we're going to have a great time. It's a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And Caleb, if people would like to see you having a great time on the internet, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at Caleb Lebster. That's CalebLebster. Jake, where can people find you online?
They can still very confusingly find me online on Twitter at Jake_Mori, or on Instagram at Jakey Mori. That's JakeyMorry, or indeed on Letterboxd at Jake Reesh. That's JakeyReesh. But we are Maybe You Like It Productions, and this is the Maybe You Like It podcast. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Maybe You Like It. That's with the letter U, or on Facebook at Maybe You Like It Productions. That's with the word U, or you can visit our website at www.maybeyoulikeit.co.uk, or drop us an email at info@maybeyoulikeit.co.uk, and do give us a little review or like wherever you get your podcasts. Spotify have just introduced a new rating feature for podcasts, which is very new and very
exciting.
Go ahead
and rate us.
So if you're listening on Spotify right now, or even if you're not, go search us on Spotify and just scroll up to the top there. Go on. Right now, go on.
Right now.
Click the little star thing and give us those 5 sweet stars, and we thank you very much. But otherwise, maybe you like that, maybe you didn't. Next week, we'll have a different guest, but that's another story.
That was a Maybe You Like It production.
Maybe you liked it, maybe you didn't.